Welcome to the C Word, the Conservatives podcast. Today we're talking about heritage skills.
My name is Liz Hebert. I'm a paintings conservator based in Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
I'm Solange Masher. I'm a book conservator based in Sheffield, England.
Hi, everybody. Solange and I have some exciting news about this season that we wanted to share with you all. Our sponsor from last season, you may remember, Bev Art, has actually moved forward with us into season 16.
Keep your eyes peeled on our socials for a YouTube review of their products. So I'm a bit jealous because I'm going on holiday. So Liz is going to be the one to get to play around with the toy.
Yeah, it's the same sensor that we talked about last season. It's just a little like relative humidity and temperature monitor, essentially, really, really small. I'm excited to use it as well. I'm going to use it, a little spoiler, I'm going to use it around my house, I think, and learn some stuff about what my situation is in my flat.
Actually, it's really funny. Like, I'm a total nerd about the humidity in my house.
Oh, I bet. Being a book and paper conservator, I'm sure.
I know. I have a dehumidifier. We really don't need one. maybe after you've had a go with this.
Yeah, we'll send it around.
Yeah. You'll hear a bit more from us about Bev Art over the coming season. But as our beloved listeners, I'm sure you'll be pleased that we have a sponsor.
Yeah. Be sure to check out a link to their website in the show notes below.
I'm Mary Lewis. I'm head of craft sustainability at Heritage Crafts. I'm also a basket maker and knitter on the side.
Welcome, Mary.
Yes, welcome. I can see for our listeners, you won't be able to see, but behind Mary, she has some lovely weaving. I assume that that's work that you've done yourself.
I've actually been, I know you can't see it, but I'm preparing a basket for a workshop that I want to teach first to my colleagues. So at Heritage Crafts, we're quite keen on getting together to learn skills all together so that we have an understanding of what we're talking about when we meet with craft people. So yeah, it's my turn to do a bit of basketry with the team.
Wonderful.
Actually, I went to an open day at a studio recently where they were making their own fibers for weaving, so like out of all sorts of things like brambles, nettles,
making cordage, and I use dandelion and daffodil and all kinds of different local fibers that I forage. I mostly use willow, like most basket makers do, but there's lots of other things as well.
I was going to ask if you use a lot of local materials for your baskets, but also if the type of weave is informed by anything regional to you or historical?
Yes, I do use forage materials. I use a combination of commercially bought willow, which is grown specifically for basketry, but I also forage locally for hazel, willow, bramble, all kinds of different materials, rush. And yes, it's quite an interesting point from the Heritage Crafts point of view, actually, is that a lot of our really old traditional baskets were made from a much wider variety of materials. So a lot of the kind of really ancient indigenous baskets, if you want to use that word, the kind of locally produced baskets would have been made from things like hazel, oak, rush, marram grass, that would have been harvested locally. And a lot of those have been replaced by, as when the commercial willow basketry industry took off, so in the 18th and 19th century, then a lot of those traditional materials fell by the wayside because they were often a lot slower or more difficult to do or whatever.
Sure.
So a lot of those have become a lot rarer than the commercial willow baskets. So it's and we're seeing a really exciting resurgence of those things now. So people are really interested in what they can harvest themselves, rediscovering some of those older types, slower types of making. It's really interesting. And they're very different styles of baskets. So you'll see coiled baskets that look a lot like things you might associate with African baskets or South American baskets, but actually they were done here too, because those skills and techniques are quite universal.
I lived in Charleston in South Carolina for a summer, and one of the most common crafts that you would see being done or being sold was all local baskets as well, made from sweetgrass, I believe. Really, really beautiful work.
Yeah, so sweetgrass baskets are quite similar to the marram grass baskets that you find in Wales, which is a completely extinct craft now, but they were made.
Wow, really?
I've made, it's illegal to harvest marram commercially because it's a protected species. So it's fallen out of use. I've done a bit of marram grass basketry because I got some permission from Natural Resources Wales to do some harvesting. To look at that craft. So that's really interesting, but it does look a lot, it's almost exactly the same technique as the sweetgrass baskets.
So how did you get interested in basket weaving specifically or in craft in general?
It goes back to my childhood. I was brought up in a very craft orientated context. So my dad's a craftsman and ran a craft charity. So I was surrounded by particularly woody craft. So a lot of coppice workers, basket makers. Coracle making is something that's been all through my life. All sorts of craft. I've just done it all my life. It's very much a part of my existence. I can't imagine not doing it really.
I was just thinking while you were talking how this linked into something we touched on just before we started recording the episode about how it's a difficult time now at the moment politically and for young people. And I was just thinking these kinds of techniques of making with our hands and making useful objects is actually such a balm for the current situation that we're in. It gives you a sense of agency and control in a world where things feel out of control. And I think that's part of one of the reasons why I feel like it's so important, that because we as conservators, we focus on preserving objects that have relevance to hi our history, to preserve our history. But we don't expect those objects to support themselves financially. And yet, in society, we expect crafts to be financially viable in order to survive. But there's kind of a mismatch there because the actual knowledge of doing the craft itself is a form of heritage that needs to be preserved and can be just lost in a generation.
Yeah, and that's where that's why we lobbied so heavily for the Convention on Intangible Cultural Heritage to be ratified by the UK government, which it now has been. It's been done about a year now. And that's because that is so intangible cultural heritage is the elements of our cultural heritage that have to be enacted through a human. So it includes all things like our folk dances, our rituals, our social practices, but it also includes crafts. Craftsmanship and craftsmanship being the word that UNESCO use. We try not to use the gendered term, but yeah, that it's all these things that you can't. And this is also where heritage crafts came from as a concept, really, because a lot of the craft makers felt that too much emphasis had gone on to the object, so almost a fetishization of that object that goes on a plinth or on a wall in a gallery, and they are beautiful. They are, and we love that. However, we felt that there wasn't enough focus on the skills and knowledge that it needed to make those objects. So these incredible objects are merely manifestations of our human knowledge and skill. And they're as much a part of our cultural heritage as the object. So whilst we think it's still important to preserve those objects as those manifestations of skill, they don't mean anything really without the skills and knowledge ultimately, and they'll ultimately go. There's only so long you can keep conserving something. And a lot of craftspeople, if you ask them, would say, well, I'll just make you another one.
As conservators, we know from working on objects that if you haven't been taught how to make a certain thing, you can't necessarily just look at it and figure out how to make it. That knowledge has to be taught and passed down. And I think like maybe most people in society may not quite grasp that or understand that because they haven't sort of been exposed to that.
I think also, and through no fault of anybody's, it's become a very academic pursuit, conservation, and that's great. I mean, there's a lot of amazing knowledge and skill in that academic approach to conserving objects. However, that needs to go alongside the making and the understanding of materials and materiality and practicalities, and like, how physically do you make something fit together and work?
The physicality is very important.
Yeah.
And I was thinking as you were speaking earlier, actually, that Solange actually has a very similar background in coming to book and paper conservation, and that her mother was a bookbinder. And so it was something that she grew up with and clearly has experience working with and making books. Mm-hmm. And then my education as well is I learned how to make a painting historically using historical methods as part of my initial education, which I have not seen done in every program. And I personally found it to be incredibly informative, not only as a conservator, but also as a viewer and appreciator of arts.
Yeah, I think and some educational establishments do it incredibly well. We work with places like West Dean and the City Guilds of London Art School, who I think do incredible work that's very much rooted in craft and craft making. But they have also, some people have expressed concern that maybe the craft side of it is not as strong as it used to be. I think there's always maybe been a bit of an assumption that the craft's always going to be there. Mm. And actually we're now in a situation where some of those things are really quite tenuous. And actually we still need the craft elements to work alongside the conservation elements to ensure sustainability, really. We always talk about, we haven't talked about the Red List of Endangered Crafts yet, but we use that methodology that borrows from the Red List of Endangered Species. So we often use these kind of nature-based metaphors for how we talk, but we also talk about ecosystems and, you know, how actually craft is a massive ecosystem, and you need all the constituent parts of that ecosystem to be functioning: the supply chains, the materials, the consumers, the hobby makers, the master crafts people. All of those things need to be functioning in order for the whole ecosystem to be operational and healthy. And if you lose one part of that, then it has knock-on effects all through the supply chain. One significant loss we had on the last Red List was the loss of flat glass manufacture in the UK. So hand-blown sheet glass making. So that would be the antique glass that you'd use for repairing historic stained glass windows, for example.
Yeah.
So that's now no longer available in the UK. So that has a knock-on effect through the supply chain, because it's more expensive. It's more difficult maybe to get those exact specific colour matches that you need. It just makes it that much more difficult to get those that exact product that you need for the job, and then that has a knock-on effect, doesn't it? So the consumer, and yeah,
that reminds me of before we got together. I was looking up something that I've always been really fascinated by, which is the Japanese living national treasures.
Yes,
so in Japan, they identify, there's a set number of craftspeople every year. I think it's 121 per year. And you can't replace they can't be replaced unless someone dies. They each receive 200 million yen, which is around £10,000 a year, to just keep doing their craft. And that's amazing. But I was looking at the list, and one of them makes the paper, one of the papers that we use in conservation, in paper conservation. And I thought, wow, okay, so if the Japanese government wasn't supporting that, maybe I wouldn't be able to get hold of the paper I need.
Yeah, I think that's quite likely. Also, I think we're talking about, I think one function that the Red List serves, I mean, obviously it's enormous now. So we represent 259 different crafts, and that's going to go over 300 when I republish the list in a couple of months' time. It's not just about things dying out. It's about representing all that diversity and that very niche occupation. So it's as much a celebration of all these kind of rare, precious, diverse specialisms that people have, as it is about a whole list of things, a gloomy list of things that are dying out. And we never want it to be that. It's more about representing, putting under one umbrella all this extraordinary diversity of knowledge and skill that we have in this country. And we rely on from other countries as well. So a lot of our materials and things will be brought in from overseas and always have been. So again, it's that widening ecosystem and network that needs to function for these crafts to be practiced.
Well, this leads in well to a question that I had for you, Mary. Why is it important for people to engage with craft?
From a starting point, we've always made the case that crafts are just as important for our cultural heritage as any other creative occupation. So it's just as important as our dance traditions, our song, our theatre, our film, all of these things that we think of as part of our creative and cultural heritage as a nation and which we're good at. Crafts have always sort of had a slightly poor, they've always been a slightly poor relation to other arts and contemporary craft. And we want to change that. So we want to elevate heritage craftspeople and people practicing traditional crafts to the same level as everybody else. And they're also, we touched on this at the beginning, they're always given this kind of label of they're having to be commercially viable, which we don't give to other, necessarily to other aspects of the arts. Like we expect our arts, our theatre, our opera, our ballet to be subsidised to a certain extent. And we wouldn't ever say we don't think they should exist if they can't pay for themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just as difficult to be a professional poet as it is to be a professional craftsperson, but we don't put it in the same bracket of it has to be commercially viable to survive. So, I mean, and then as in terms of engaging with it, then that can happen on all different levels. So, you know, it's really important for us to all maybe have the opportunity to sing as part of our well-being, a part of engaging with our cultural heritage, but we're not all going to be professional opera singers. It's just the same with crafts. You know, we can engage on a really small level for well-being, for engaging maybe with our local area, our landscape, our heritage. Maybe there's a specific craft that's practiced locally that you can engage with. It's also great for socializing and bringing people together. And it genuinely is something that everyone can do. Craft is really accessible to a wide range of people, and lots of people do it anyway, even if they don't tell you about it. Whether it's putting up a shelf or, you know, knitting or crochet or,
A conversation that I've actually seen on the internet quite often is about how craft or singing, a lot of the things that you've mentioned aren't just skills that you have to work on and achieve. It's something that just naturally happens as part of being human.
It's a really important part of who we are. For us, it's a social justice issue to a certain extent, and that we think that all people, particularly all young people, should have the opportunity to try it out, because it is part of what makes us human, is to make things and to use our hands. And if we don't, then we lose those skills. We start losing those haptic skills. We start losing our understanding of materials, the understanding of where things come from and how they're made. And I always think it's kind of, if you learn to carve a spoon, that's going to give you a bit of a better appreciation of how a chair is made. You're not learning that craft, but it gives you a bit of understanding of where things come from. My partner makes yurts, which isn't yet a UK heritage craft, but I've had people, and our company is called Yurt Maker, and I've had people stand in the yurts and go, "But you didn't make it, did you?" And he's like, "Well, how do you think it arrived here? It can't just manifest." Everything is made. It might be made in a factory context, but most of those factories will still have people with hand skill who are making things. And this underpins all of our culture and lots of our manufacturing in the UK. Even if things are made on a production line, they probably will have been made and prototyped at some point by a person, because you have to do that in order to design something and understand the materials. So, making underpins everything, especially things like our theatre and our film sector. You know, there's vast craftspeople underpinning that. Fashion, most of our clothes are still made by a person on a sewing machine, even if they're made in a factory context. We're detached from that making process because it happens elsewhere mostly, but it's still a high level of hand skill going into making these garments that we all take for granted as, you know, something that we have in our lives, and they're almost considered disposable.
I also think that it can give young people a sense of confidence as well, developing that
autonomy.
Yeah. I had a really interesting conversation with some stone letter carvers. Their podcast is the Stone Carving and Lettering Takeaway, Nina Bilby and Charlotte Howarth. And they were saying that they'd noticed a difference in people training coming up now, that it seems that perhaps young people are doing less and less with their hands as they grow up. And so their confidence with hand skills and their expectation of how quickly they'll reach the end point is less. Like they kind of expect to reach an end point quicker and get, but they're kind of, yeah, the way that they approach materials is maybe being developed less as they're growing up. And, you know, like kids are just quite often on devices more. I wonder if it's like interacting with the physical world and the physical material can almost build a kind of confidence and sense of agency.
I think for sure. And I think the it touches on this, what I was saying earlier on about social justice. And I think we are we're seeing a lot of young people. I mean, it's a very common thing that I hear from, particularly from older makers, is that young people are not interested anymore, which I don't buy at all, because they absolutely are interested. But how can they be interested in things that they don't know about? You know, it's our job to make sure that they do know about them and they have access to them. But what I would say is I think they're interested in a different way. I would say that they're and they're networking in a different way. So they're not necessarily finding the traditional guilds and associations that represent craft, because why would they want to be treasurer of a lace society? You know, it's not that, I can imagine, not very interesting to most young people. However, they might be engaging with it on social media, watching people making lace on TikTok, something like that, and networking and getting on with things in a different way. So we need to harness that. I think you can see it in things like the rise of spoon carving or bowl making is a really good example. So my dad is a spoon carver. He's a Welsh spoon carver. Tried to teach people through the 80s and 90s, not an awful lot of interest, really, to be honest. But as social media kicked in and people started looking at getting inspired by Scandinavian design and those spoon carvers, that it's taken off now. And there are whole festivals devoted to spoon carving now. So you can go and spend a week in a field just making spoons with 500 other people. There are hundreds of people doing it now, which is fabulous. But that, and a lot of them are young people, but that's because that emerged from a different kind of networking and a different kind of dissemination. And people want to do it because, I mean, we don't need to make spoons, do we? You know, realistically, as a tool, we don't need to make them. But people, they also are probably the most primitive tool, aren't they? Maybe apart from a knife, the spoon, like just the tool to be able to feed ourselves with, has got to be like one of the most primitive things that we can do as a human.
Yeah, something kind of reassuring about knowing if you needed to, you can make it.
Yeah, and being able to make it from a piece of wood that's been harvested, you know, a piece of green wood that's been harvested sustainably, probably very close to where you're making it. You need very few tools. It couldn't be more sustainable, really, if you tried. And it's a very authentic experience, isn't it? And that's what people are looking for. They're looking for those authentic experiences. They're looking for that contact. They're looking for the peace of mind, because particularly men are often not engaged with these kind of activities very much as a group. So women are generally have done more of that, because you'll have knitting groups and embroidery sewing bees and embroidery groups, and that traditionally women have networked much better around things like that. But men don't so much. So a group of men sitting side by side having a conversation whilst they're making is a very powerful tool for well-being, and people communicate and connect in a very different way when they're doing something like that. I do a lot of different crafts, and basketry is my main one, but you know, when it hits the fan, spoon carving is the one I go to for like proper like immersion in something that I know is gonna sort my brain out, get those things back in line.
Yeah, I really want to make a spoon now.
Yeah, I feel like we haven't addressed enough. There's lots of things we could talk about around the intersection between conservation and baking, I think, but maybe that's for another conversation. But
oh no, get into it.
Yeah, we've thought a lot about this recently because of the red list. So obviously, we talk mostly about, mostly what we focus on is making. But a lot of that does obviously overlap significantly with repair, conservation and restoration.
Yeah.
So it's all those different variations of how craft skills are applied, which are really interesting. So we are actually looking at the potential for whether there's scope to have conservation skills listed within the red list or separately from the red list or alongside, because there's a lot of hand skill that are specifically conservation based practices.
A lot of the time conservators learn these skills in order to use it in their conservation work, but they're not considering themselves a craftsperson.
That's very true. Yeah,
there's huge overlaps. We did some really interesting work with them. Jerry Alaboni at the City and Guild of London Art School last year. So he a couple of years ago. So he's a picture frame conservator. And actually it was a really, I think from both sides, we found it a useful exercise. So he went off to find, you know, how many people are still making these picture frames that he spends a lot of time conserving. And, you know, and then we're looking at quite a small number now of people. Mm-hmm. And then you also then start to unpick, okay, well, the bits that can you still get the materials? So actually, supplies and materials are quite limited now. There's only a couple of suppliers. People who make the molds that you cast the pieces of frame in, they aren't being made anymore. So how do you source and address that? So it was really interesting to unpick some of those issues and look at it from a making point of view as well as just from a conservation point of view.
Mm.
It's all fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. I've not thought of it in that kind of holistic way before, but it totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Who makes the little thingamajiggy that you need to do the thing?
And where do you get compo? Where do you get compo from? You know, so if you're making composition picture frames, you know, there's these slightly, you know, guarded recipes that people have.
Mm. That's something that we've definitely talked about on this new word quite a lot, is how protective historically conservators are of recipes or techniques.
And we've seen, we used to see a lot more of that in craft and a lot less now. It's definitely changing. Yeah. And I think that is something that can change with lobbying and awareness raising. Because obviously from a commercial point of view, I understand why people do that. But from a skills point of view, it's not terribly helpful. People are protective about their particular areas.
In conservation, it comes from this slightly strange idea that fear that people will try and do conservation themselves, and then mess it up and ruin.
That makes more jobs for conservators, doesn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, with craft, I would say the same is true. It's a slightly different nuance to that. So I think people are scared that lots of people will start making poor quality things and flooding the market. Over time, I don't think that is actually a genuine issue. I think, yes, I mean, so I'm, you know, my craft is basketry, and you see an awful lot of terrible baskets out there. But they don't last long, you know. They don't, those people, if they're not serious practitioners, they're not going to actually survive. Their work is not really up to scratch unless they raise their skills. And all it's done, it's served to highlight the people who are the best, and the people can see that skills progression. So they aspire to being like the top makers. So they, you know, they know who those, we know who those people are. And actually, what through a culture of skills sharing, which I think the basketry community is good at, it's all it's done is create a lot more, improve the skill base, because people, it pulls the top, you know, it pulls up the, in a way, the bottom pulls up the top, if you see what I mean.
You know,
they all want to learn and bring their skills. So actually, it's improved the skills at the top end as well, if that makes sense.
I think that's a wonderful way to reframe it.
Yeah. And I've seen very little, I don't have any stats to back this up. I don't, in my time working with craft people, I don't see any evidence of more people practicing, meaning that craft is threatened. All I see is you've got more customers, you've got a bigger market, you know, more people are aware of it. You're more likely to sell more things. Because if there's only two people doing craft, it's not really commercially viable. Because if even if those people are busy and they've got a lot of work on, which they often are, if you can't, if there's something's not available in the open market, it's well, that threatens the viability of it, doesn't it? Is that people can't get it, they just go and buy something else. So I think, yeah, I think it has to be a vibrant, there has to be a certain level of competition, is the right word, but exchange and a certain body of people doing something to make it work. There's no point being the last person doing something. And we've definitely got examples of crass people who've dined out for years on being the last whatever. And that's also not terribly helpful, really, because we don't want that to happen. We want more to take them on and run with them.
Given that it is really hard to survive and make a living sometimes as a craftsperson, do you see lots of people having it as a very serious hobby, side hustle?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think those people are really key.
Yeah.
For the survival of the sector. And people coming in second careers as well. Because whilst, you know, obviously what we want is to be completely equitable and for everyone to be able to participate. In reality, that's not always the case. So some of the people doing some of the best work are people who are a bit older. Maybe they've got a bit of money behind them. They've got a bit more time to spend. Mm-hmm. They can make a conscious choice that that's what they want to spend their time doing.
Yeah.
Maybe after they've made living doing something else.
Because I do sometimes worry with conservation that if I encourage young people to pursue it as a career without giving them the full picture of where they might find themselves financially, that I'm doing them a disservice.
Yeah, absolutely. It has to be responsible. And we're really conscious of that, because we can't be promoting these careers to young people if they're not viable or sustainable. Yeah. So there is a really delicate balance to be struck there. So that's something we're very conscious of, because it isn't responsible to say that people can do things if that's not viable. However, I would say the same about whether you want to be an actor or a pop star.
Absolutely. My daughter told me she wants to be an artist, and I was like, darling, that's brilliant, but you're going to have to work really hard. So then she told me she's going to become a banker and then an artist.
Yeah. I think there's a lot we can do around also saying how craft skills are making underpin a lot of other things. So you don't have to be a starving weaver in a garret under loft to be a craft person. There's lots of other things that involve making things that do underpin viable. Careers. It's just the same as with any other creative occupation, isn't it? That if you want to do art, you can't afford to be an artist, but you might be an art teacher or a therapist or some other occupation that's
your passion, and it might lead you somewhere. It can open different doors that you didn't.
I mean, I'd love to be able to say, yes, you can make your career as a silversmith. Some people can. Some people do, and they do it extremely well. A lot of people really find it hard and don't. So it's a balance that has to be struck. We are really worried, though, that it all becomes quite elitist, and that actually we will be in a situation, just as we are with our other creative careers, that you can only do it if you've got a bit of money behind you to start with. So the creeping elitism in all arts is an issue that we have to be aware of. So that's about, it's not just about cash, it's about access to opportunities. And where you come from. It's a lot about who you know.
With the arts, and perhaps craft in particular, when we're talking about having careers or, you know, going on to turn this into something involving money, I think it's one of the reasons it's so fascinating from a job perspective, is that there are a lot of transferable skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something we're talking about a lot on this season of our podcast about, being being a private conservator doesn't just mean that you learn how to do all of the things necessary to do your job as a conservator. You also take on all of the skills of being a business owner and having to market yourself in that way and network. And I'm sure that it's exactly the same with any cultural or craft profession.
Yeah, One of the things I always think is also really important is for showing young people that talking to them about self-determination. So what that you can create your own career. 15% of the UK workforce is self-employed, but we don't ever really talk about it in terms of career option. So whether you're a mechanic or a plumber or a wheelwright, it doesn't matter. It's that opportunity to define your own journey and your own incomes is something that we don't talk to people about enough. It's not an easy option, but it is something that a lot of people do. There are good occupations. There are good salaries to be had. If you go into heritage building skills, then there are some really good salaried careers to be had doing that sort of stuff. They are out there.
Well, that's a question that we get sometimes is what type of conservation is there a shortage of? Because I'm thinking about what type of conservation to train in. But I wonder if that's probably also a thing for heritage crafts is, well, what?
Yeah, I don't have data on that. That's not something that we ask at the moment. Anecdotally, I would say a lot of the building craft skills fall into
Of
that.
course.
Because what we're tending to see happen is that lots of firms will advertise that they do heritage building skills. That's fine, heritage brickwork and roofing, that kind of thing. But actually, what they'd be doing in a lot of these cases, they'll be subcontracting that work to other companies, and those subcontractors will be working for numerous companies. So actually, when you drill down into how many people are actually doing them, it actually is a lot less than it looks. So you do have to be aware of that. And then also, those smaller companies have less capacity to invest in skills. They don't have the time, they don't have the money to take on trainees. Even if they wanted to do it completely altruistically to pass on skills, they probably don't want to pay for it. Because essentially what they're doing is training up other people to be self-employed, which is great. They want their sector to be vibrant and viable as well, but they don't want that to actually cost them.
It feels to me like the idea of, you get student, you get a student loan to go to university. If only you could have some kind of equivalent loan for paying to be an apprentice. Originally,
Yeah, you would have paid to be an
you would
apprentice,
pay to be an apprentice, and you'd live at home and so forth to save money.
There is obviously there's the government funded apprenticeship levy. All companies over a certain amount have to put money into the apprenticeship levy. So in theory, that funding is there, but what it means in reality on the ground, it's really not fit for purpose for small micro businesses or self-employed, because it covers the college element and the assessment and all of that. Well, it doesn't cover any living expenses for the apprentice, and it doesn't cover anything for the business taking on the apprentice. So the business still has to pay the apprentice.
That's
It's quite a big ask for a small business. It's all right if you're PricewaterhouseCoopers or McDonald's, and you can absorb, got a high turnover of staff, you can absorb people, and you've got good pathways for people to progress. And you can afford the wastage of people who drop out. It's not like that if you're a one person organized or two one or two people and you take on a trainee. That's a big investment, not just in cash, but in time and energy and creating that relationship that you have to have to be a trainer and trainee. It's quite a key part of making it successful is that relationship. So yeah, it's hard to make that work without some. So we're working on some pilot work at the moment to provide some of that support to the businesses so that they can actually take on apprentices.
Yeah, because that's key, really.
Yeah, so we're starting a little project funded in partnership with the Marchmont Foundation. So they're gonna we're piloting that starting quite soon. So yeah, that should be quite exciting.
Really?
So that's looking at that model basically is how can you front load it so that the business has support to actually take on the trainees.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, we'd love to hear about that.
And we do a lot of work with the Institute for Apprenticeships and Sitting Guild and people like that as well. They're very aware of the problem. However, the current system doesn't allow for the model that we need it to have. It also doesn't work for niche occupations because the apprenticeship trailblazers have to have a certain cohort. You have to be able to demonstrate a certain cohort of learners to make them sustainable. Or financially viable, because no college is going to run them if they, if you're only looking at five learners a year.
And that's all work that has to happen at the front end before you even apply for the.
So what's happened is that some of these trailblazers exist. So, for example, something like clock and watchmaking that exists as an apprenticeship standard, but no one's delivering it because no college will take it on because it's not commercially viable in that sense. Our argument being, well, they're never going to be, are they? Because we don't need to train 250 organ makers, but we need to train some. So it's never going to work. So it's not fit for purpose
For
for
this.
these niche occupations.
Apprenticeships haven't taken off in conservation, I think, for similar.
They haven't taken off across any of the crafts and skills really. If you look at the stats, the vast majority of apprenticeships are going through in STEM because that's what's been publicized so heavily, isn't it? So there's lots of people going in through science, technology, engineering, that side of things, and then also things like finance and where there's just lots and lots of jobs. IT, it doesn't, like, there's an irony, isn't there, in the apprenticeship concept comes from craft and trade, and that's the very area that it's not serving at the
Yeah,
moment.
that's so true.
But we can't go back to the past. I mean, I get people saying all the time, oh well, I've to served 7 years time served apprenticeship, spent the first year sweeping the floors. I mean, we're not going back to that. We can't. It would be naive to think that we can reintroduce old-fashioned apprenticeships because they're just not going to work in this day and age. So we need to find a new way of doing it that does work for employers. It works for young people.
And it works into the long term in terms of them actually going on to have this as a career and investing their time into preserving the skills.
We're not going back to the past, and there's no point in doing that. But we've always thought that what we do is much more about the future than it is about the past anyway, despite the word heritage, which is a bit misleading, I think, sometimes. We can't do anything about the past, but we can do something about the future. So it's all, we're very much a future-focused organization, and one that will acknowledge that these skills are all mutable, it's all changeable, it will all, we have to acknowledge change. But maybe we can do that without throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
So, just a fun question to end on. So, what do you think will be the next sort of like big trendy craft? Because it
It's going to be
was
lace making.
Actually, going to be lace making too.
Maybe let's start a trend. I don't know. I think that, I mean, natural materials are really big at the moment. I think lots of people are looking at natural materials. Lots of things around tool making and that kind of thing. But yeah,
Dying
let's
with
make a
plants.
case. Let's make a case for the crafts that are often associated with old ladies, because I think they suffer, and I think they've always suffered in terms of profile because they were always very low paid, a lot of them, or very domestic. And I think they've always been perceived as second class because of that. So, things like the stonemasons and the wood carvers and things have always enjoyed that artisan status, whereas the lace makers and the knitters and the embroiderers haven't had that same status. So that would be my plea, is for the those crafts that we may be considered to be irrelevant.
I'd be curious to ask you, just because you know so much more about craft than I do. I had this theory that part of the reason, at least, why knitting has become so popular in the last 10, 15 years, like getting this real international cult status almost, is not only because it was a, it's something that's gotten transferred down to the younger generation. But for me, it also feels like it has something to do with computers, because knitting and computers are like old card readers that you would have to make some kind of loom is very similar to how a contemporary computer functions. And have you heard any discussion about there being a correlation between those?
Well, the loom was the first computer, right? The loom,
yeah,
was
exactly.
The first computer. So the the printed weaving
and knitting. Like when you read a knitting instructions, it's sort of like in a binary, similar to how computers speak to each other.
No, absolutely. I think there's a lot there. Oh, I mean, we could go on for hours about this. It's about pattern, isn't it? It's about pattern and repetition and code. If you've ever read, I remember sitting with a friend of mine who's also a knitter, and we both have children in primary school, and we were invited in to listen to a presentation about coding, computer coding. And we were both sitting at the back. And at one point, Jo said to me, "It's just a knitting pattern. Think of it like a knitting pattern." And it's exactly that. You know, knitting patterns are code. And if you can read, and you know, it's just a different kind of code, isn't it? Absolutely. I think the thinking skills are immense, you know, like the numeracy and the skills that you need. I mean, I can bore you for hours about knitting, but traditionally in the UK, so the way they do it in Shetland, for example, is traditionally knitted top down. So you'd start at the top, you'd knit your patterned yoke, and the whole jumper's knitted as one piece. So you're knitting it in three dimensions, essentially.
Oh my God.
They wouldn't have had a pattern. They would have known how to size, and they would have done it as they go. You know, they would have done that.
Mind-boggling.
So they're doing a lot of that is a mental process. They would have designed their own motifs. They might have charted them on charts, but yeah. But with the rise of women's magazines and things through the 50s, 60s, a lot of those patterns became transferred. I mean, forgive me if my dates aren't exactly right, but a lot of those became then about flat patterns. So just like a sewing pattern was presented. So knitting patterns became about making pieces like you would for a sewing pattern, which are knitted individually and then sewn together. Because that came from sewing patterns.
Yeah.
Rather than how knitting was traditionally done. So whilst that enabled a lot of access for a lot of people, so that, you know, that in some ways that democratized access to knitting, it also limited people quite a lot, because it's much harder to make your own flat patterns than it is to learn how to knit
onto your body.
Yeah, onto your body.
Mm-hmm.
So people became quite limited and narrow. So a lot of like the older generation will knit to flat patterns very well, in a very skilled way. But the number of patterns available to them were quite small. Mm. Whereas now, you know, you can get whatever you want. I mean, if you go on this. Thousands, hundreds of thousands of patterns available online, and people are learning again how to knit in one piece. So they do it in Scandinavia, and that's come on again, been reintroduced from Scandinavia, and where they never stopped doing it. So it's quite interesting to see how those things evolve, and it's a much more, I guess, empowering way to do it than to be stuck rigidly to a set of patterns that you could have bought in the back of Women's Own magazine or wherever they came from.
Oh, this has been such an enlightening conversation. It's just brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today I'm reviewing Conservation of Plasticasts, edited by Jacob Dubal, a 2023 Archetype publication. Firstly, I love that this book is made up of knowledge from a non-English speaking area. Many or possibly all of the authors are Czech, and the papers are translated. The info is applicable to anywhere with plastic casts, but I really appreciate the non-Anglocentric angle. Maybe a little bit extra because English isn't my first language. The book starts by setting the scene. What are plastic casts and what are the issues? As someone who's seen objects in various states, from tenderly looked after to almost discarded, I felt that this was a really good, frank chapter on the subject. Next up is a history lesson, followed by a chapter on manufacture. Next, we've got a fascinating deep dive into surface finishes, of which there are many, and each with a different purpose, followed by a chapter on gypsum as a material. For me, this was a really enlightening chapter, as it gave really concrete answers on solubility and RH sensitivity. Next up is a section dedicated to damage types, which is very neatly complemented by a great appendix, which is an illustrated glossary of damage. Absolutely invaluable, guys. Followed by a chapter about how to examine plasticasts. I felt that was a particularly good addition if you're new to plasticasts, and if this is something you haven't looked after before, then sort of knowing what to look for and how to condition check something is actually a really valuable addition to the book. After this, we've got a chapter introducing the most common conservation issues, and then some delightfully practical sections on cleaning, consolidation, gluing, and retouching. Now, this was really what I was here for, to be honest, because I do love something that gives a bit of practical information. It won't tell you exactly what to do in, you know, your exact circumstances, but what it does do is it gives you insights into people's experience of different materials. The relatively few sort of case studies and published papers that are out there currently on the subject and what they've said, what their findings were. So I felt like it was a really good overview. It's not a recipe book, nothing of the sort, but it does provide a lot of the information that you might need in one place, which is quite nice. Finally, there's a chapter on storage and transportation, things like environmental conditions, and at the end, there's a conclusion. This does seem to be the first book of its kind, and really, if you have any plaster in your collection, not just giant plaster casts, I think this would actually be a really valuable addition to your library. It certainly gave me loads of insights, and I really, really appreciated how concrete it was. And I have to say it was superbly translated. It's a thing of absolute beauty, and the images are stunning. So I really feel like this is a really useful addition to anyone's library. I think as a conservator with some knowledge of plaster, but not like all the knowledge in the universe, I found this really useful. There is quite a lot of make sure you get an expert involved, sort of disclaimer type stuff going on in the book. But I feel like you sort of can't get away from that. You know, if you're out of your depth, get an expert in. That's something we're all fairly familiar with. But it still gave a really good grounding in what plastic casts are, how they may have been made, some of the common problems, and some potential solutions to those problems. I just really appreciated it. And as I said, the images are absolutely stunning. You know, the comparisons of different cleaning methods on different objects and all of that. I don't know, it's a good book. I guess it's as simple as that. I think it's a good book. This book does a lot in its 134 pages, and you can get your own copy from archetype.co.uk for £55. Thanks for listening. We're the C Word, and today you've been listening to Solange, Liz and Mary. Join us next time for an episode about how to choose a specialism. In the meantime, you can check out our website at thecword.show. Email us at thecwordpodcast@gmail.com or check us out on social media. We are on almost everything. The intro and outro music is Spring by Didi Misik, used under Creative Commons Attribution License, with additional music and sound effects by Callum Robertson. As always, this has been a Wooden Dice production.